Proceed.
May it please the court. This court in the Johnson versus McCulloch case in 2010 and then later in Rule 69025 advised lawyers that we must use reasonable efforts to examine the litigation history on CaseNet of those jurors selected but not impaneled and present to the trial court any relevant information prior to trial. Unfortunately, Mr. McFadden's case was tried before Johnson and tried, obviously, before the rule was enacted, and that mandate took effect. Thus, while this court can say legitimately, we told you so, the situation that case and that rule sought to avoid was created, and the question becomes, do we resolve it now?
How would CaseNet have shown that?
I think, Your Honor, in Johnson versus McCulloch, we at least were told that we could look at CaseNet and try to figure out if someone served. CaseNet might not have helped in this case since
but this guy was in the veneer.
Exactly.
And do we have any evidence that it was intentional? His neglect of mentioning this when he was in the veneer and asked the question, whether that was intentional with respect to this murder trial?
Well, I think that's the question here. Because if we look at the facts of this case, the non-disclosure is pretty clear. The questions that Judge Gartner proposed to the panel on which Mr. Williams sat in this case were very pointed. Does anybody recognize Vincent McFadden?
But there's no, do you think that we should presume as a matter of law that someone who was part of the veneer, probably looking at the back of someone's head 3 years before, would recognize them 3 years later?
Well, Your Honor, I think
you that's what we'd have to do, isn't it? Find as a matter of law.
How many people were in there? I mean, if it was a death case, was it a substantial panel?
They're divided into panels, and I'm trying to think right now how many people they divided it into for each panel. I don't think it was over 30.
The first case was an assault case.
That was very small. And I think what we have to look at in terms of this, not first the non-disclosure, because Mays and Johnson both tell us that first we figure out whether there was non-disclosure, and then we go to your question, Judge Teitelman, whether it's intentional or unintentional. And the non-disclosure, the cases that this court has developed, Mays, Johnson, and the other case, all look at, was the question clear? And we don't have to say, does this person necessarily remember it, but is it reasonable to believe that this was something that you forgot?
And the questions, what were the questions? There was a question, do you recognize Mr. McFadden?
And the other question that Judge Gartner gave him was, did you get any, and let me make sure I'm saying this accurately.
Do you have any information about him from a source?
Any source. And again, nobody, had you acquired any information about Mr. McFadden from any source? And again, nobody responded. And then he also warned the veneer members that they were supposed to decide this case based solely on information they got in this courtroom. And then Mr. Larner, the prosecutor, made sure that these veneer members were very clear about the priors that they were going to consider. And the priors included, just a few years ago, those convictions for first-degree assault and ACA. That was exactly what this man heard about when he sat through the voir dire in that assault case.
But it was just the voir dire. He didn't sit on that jury.
Exactly. He sat through the whole voir dire, and he heard about the assaults. He heard about the ACAs and in St. Louis County. And it's
why wasn't it your burden to have a hearing at which he would be questioned about why he didn't answer the questions and if he remembered and so forth?
Well, Judge, unfortunately, this was just discovered while this case was pending on appeal. Would it have been nice had we been able to figure this out earlier? You bet.
And was it discovered because after he was reconvicted, you then undertook an investigation of all jurors to see if you could come up with something?
Actually, no, Your Honor. This was happenstance on my part. As you may remember, these cases were stayed because of a PCR on the assault cases. And It was after we were after they forwarded to me the documents on the assault case, and I was looking at it and I said, Jimmy L. Williams? Wait a minute. Jimmy L. Williams. And that's when I asked the circuit court in St. Louis County, can I see, the list from that assault case? And by gosh, service tech for this battery company, wife is a marketing coordinator. In this case, he says he served on a jury 2003-2004, and that was when that assault case happened. How many Jimmy L. Williams are there? How many Jimmy L. Williams with the same job, with a wife with the same job, with no kids? It's the same guy.
Going back to my initial question.
So he disclosed it on his questionnaire?
He disclosed on his questionnaire in this case that he had served on a jury. What does he know that he didn't serve?
He thought he meant served.
Yeah. So he X's that box.
And he may have served on a jury. You don't know that the veneer is what he was talking about.
Well, but the time frame certainly is suspicious that one would say, Jimmy L. Williams, how many can there
but
be?
My question is, we don't have anything in the record to prove that it was an intentional non-disclosure.
Well,
we don't. I mean, there is nothing that compels that he intentionally did not disclose it. So, there has been no fact finding. Excuse me. There has been no fact finding that it was an intentional non-disclosure. So, you are asking us to look at this record and to find, as a matter of law, it is intentional non-disclosure.
I think we can look at it in either two ways, and I think. To me, this is intentional non-disclosure because if you look at the test that this court has established, intentional non-disclosure doesn't necessarily mean I remember it and I'm going to hide this. But is it reasonable for us to assume that it wasn't disclosed? That there, it's not like I'm being mean or something. That's not the intention.
We would have to find as a matter of law, in effect, that it's just simply unreasonable not to remember.
Not to remember
the name when you'd been on the veneer, is there?
Well, I think it's unreasonable not to remember that name, especially when coupled with the information that you're given that this is a first-degree assault and an ACA in St. Louis County. And I kept thinking back, the only time I've ever been called for jury service, I was so excited. And I was so annoyed when the case was settled as I sat there. But I don't think people forget that. And
Are you asking us for an opportunity for a hearing on this so you can question him about that issue?
I think certainly that's an alternative approach that this court could take, but I don't think we need to do that. Because either if this court finds it's not intentional non-disclosure, we can certainly look at it and see if it's unintentional non-disclosure. And the real difference there becomes if it's unintentional, prejudice is not presumed. Prejudice is presumed if it's intentional non-disclosure, and that's the real key. But I think even in this case, we can prove prejudice from what we know, because in that assault case that Mr. Williams sat through, he sat through the veneer, and if you read that voir dire, he's been told numerous times that Vince McFadden was facing three, count them, three, assault first charges and three ACAs plus an unlawful use of the weapons charge. In this case, this jury hears that he's been convicted of two ACAs, never hears about that other charge, that other assault charge, that other ACA, or the unlawful use count that apparently that jury did not find.
But that presumes he did remember.
Pardon me?
That presumes he did connect the two defendants.
Well, or is it unreasonable for us to assume that he didn't? And again, you think this is something that doesn't happen a lot of times in people's lives. People aren't usually called for jury duty every week. This is the only two times in this man's life that he's called, and both times it's Vincent McFadden.
But isn't it reasonable that he remembered the service
but maybe didn't remember the details, such as the person's name, the exact nature of the charges, how many. But he certainly remembered, you know, being called, but the details of all that for 3 years could have easily been forgotten.
Well, I think that's the stretch, Your Honor. Especially when he's told again in this case, here's Judge Gartner saying, do you know anything about this guy? Those are the first questions he hears. Then he hears from Mr. Larner repeatedly about the charges that this man was convicted of. Surely that's going to trigger something, and I think it's just unreasonable for us to say, oh, We're not going to assume that he didn't remember that. And again, it becomes a question of, is it non-disclosure and is it intentional or unintentional? Do we need to prove prejudice?
Unfortunately, most people try to get out of jury service. So wouldn't it be reasonable that if he remembered that, he would have offered it up so he could have been excused from this jury service?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, you know, the other question is, did he, you know, is the St. Louis Prosecutor's Office, their habit of excusing by peremptory strikes African Americans, is that maybe not a good policy on their part? Maybe this man wanted on this jury. And that's, I think, as legitimate an inference to take from Mr. Williams' his decision or undecision to not disclose that.
Is there a mechanism for getting a hearing on this at this point?
I think if this court were to decide that that's what needs to be done, we'd need to send it back to St. Louis County.
Or
a special master could be appointed. Either way would resolve it. But again, I think, you know, given the record that's in front of you, I don't think you have to do that. And I think that's simply adding a layer of process when we're looking at a system that is strapped for resources. And we've looked at this case, and this is not Judge Gartner's fault, and this is not I don't think this is the lawyer's fault. This is the fault of one person who didn't disclose something.
It assumes that they did it on purpose. I mean,
your
thought is that they're just not even entitled to say it didn't come to them.
Well, and no matter what, I think what we have to also look at is why we have voir dire and what that's designed to protect. And it's designed to protect Mr. McFadden's right to a fair jury trial. And is this something that in voir dire, had this been disclosed, would these lawyers have wanted to keep Mr. Williams on this panel? And I'll guarantee you that they would have wanted him struck.
Well, you just said he was African American. Maybe they would have wanted him on the panel.
Well, but an African American who hadn't already heard things that this jury wouldn't be exposed to, that's the question. But that's something that, you know, that's what voir dire is supposed to protect. And I think, and that's, this case demonstrates what happens when someone doesn't disclose that kind of service. And I think that's the problem. It just strikes a blow at the Sixth Amendment. And that, to me, is the real...
What about the fact on his questionnaire that he listed it? Is that some indication that he didn't intentionally non-disclose it? I mean, it would seem odd that somebody would go to the effort to write it down, be asked a question later, and really remember it and not...
Well, and I think that becomes a, you know, okay, I've disclosed that because somebody's asking me that question, and I'm supposed to write the answers on this form. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to tell you that, you know, I was on Vince McFadden's. I think, to me, that makes it even more troublesome.
Right, but nobody asked him about his prior jury service.
No, Your Honor, nobody asked any questions at all. And as I say,
did they ask any of the other veneer men about prior jury service?
As far as I remember from reading the record, it was only people that volunteered something about knowing someone. And
because a lot of times you'd say, well, did you find them guilty?
Right. Those kinds of questions were asked, but not
of this.
And the questions that were particularly asked of Mr. Williams were very, his answers were very short. Yes, no. And the majority of his question and answer time, because he didn't volunteer anything, and I went through the record pretty carefully. He didn't volunteer anything later on. The only times that he was ask and answer thing with Mr. Larner especially was on the death qualification. And that's when he said, you know, I can consider both punishments, blah, blah, blah. And his answers, again, were very short, yes, no. So that was all we have from Mr. Williams. Again, I think it's very troublesome that we have someone who failed to disclose this prior experience with Mr. McFadden, and especially when we know that what he heard during that experience was more than what this jury heard. It was significantly different than what this jury heard. It was three counts of both of the charges, and that's not what this jury heard. And I think when you look at this case and what this jury was asked to consider as statutory aggravators, that becomes highly problematic in terms of what he himself brought into the deliberative process and what may have occurred back in the jury room.
Now, being a public defender, and your extraordinary ability to find this fact is an incredible testimony to you and your efforts. But being a public defender, you don't have these are death penalty cases, but you don't have jury consultants that look into what who the jurors are and looks in their backgrounds and checks all this stuff out. You can't afford that kind of service.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, this was a separate office that tried this case, and I don't know what kind of jury consultants they may have had, if they had consultants at all. All I know is this was a surprise to everyone, and it's not a testament to me more than just sheer luck.
Luck is better than good.
Luck is great, and I'm never turning down luck. As I said when I signed in this morning, I didn't think I was going to need all my time, and therefore I would request that this court reverse and remand for a new and fair jury trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
May I proceed? Does anyone actually talk to this juror?
Not that I'm aware of.
It would be off the record anyway, but go ahead.
Right. And what this case ultimately boils down to, or at least this particular point in the case, is are we going to vacate this conviction and order an entirely new trial based on a series of assumptions? That being that the experience of being called in for voir dire was so significant and so exciting and so meaningful to Juror Williams that 3 years later he remembers the defendant's name, he remembers what the defendant looks like, he remembers not only what the charges were, but exactly how many counts there were.
What if there were a hearing or a special master, and he said, "Yeah, I knew, and I wanted to serve because I didn't get to serve on that jury, and I wanted to get this guy or something."
Well, and my point is that's exactly what has to happen at some point in time. I think if this claim needs to be developed with some evidence. Now,
it's not really an ineffective assistance claim. It's sort of newly discovered evidence.
I believe Johnson v. McCullough, if I'm remembering the case name right, has indicated that where something could not be brought up by the time of the new trial motion, it can be heard in a 2950.
So you think we should do a special master then?
I think there are two different ways to approach it. My preferred way would be to simply affirm this conviction, let the matter be handled at 2915 stage. If the court decides that remedy for whatever reason is not adequate,
it's not ineffective assistance of counsel, Judge Sisson.
No, but 2915 is not limited strictly to ineffective assistance of counsel. I think this does fall within the ambit of what could be brought up there. But if the court feels that appointment of a special master or some proceeding like that is the better way to go, certainly that's a better option than simply throwing this thing out and ordering an entirely new trial when we have simply not developed an adequate factual record.
Well, would there be any benefit in the original trial judge making the decision?
The original trial judge is on the Court of Appeals now, so I don't think that's going to work.
We have, under our judicial articles, we can assign anybody to do anything.
Well, I'll leave that to the court's discretion. There's always some advantage, I guess, to the trial judge having presided over the proceedings, having a little better ability to kind of judge some things based on demeanor and based on their knowledge of basically what went on. But
now, who was the judge in the earlier assault case?
I don't know that. Ms. Judge Ross? I'm told it's Judge Ross.
So,
Well, we can't order him to do anything.
At least he doesn't have to obey.
Well, I took the words out of my mouth. Yes. But again, I think the point is, in terms of saying as a matter of law that this is non-disclosure, it's non-intentional, I think we have to keep in mind that this is the significance of prior service on a jury is something that's very subjective and very personal to each individual. And generally, when intentional non-disclosure is found, regardless of a juror's testimony to the contrary, it involves an event that is very personal to that juror. Typically, is have you filed previously a personal injury suit, a medical malpractice suit, something like that. It's one thing to say, well, that's not something you're likely to forget.
Now, your opposing counsel said he was only called on two jurors. Do you know for a fact that he hadn't been called on other juries?
Well, what I don't know for sure is whether St. Louis County operates much the way that I understand St. Louis City does, whereas if you make a panel for one trial and are not picked, you kind of go back in the pool and then are subject to perhaps being picked for another jury. So I don't know for certain whether the other jury experience he talked about was necessarily being called for the voir dire and Mr. McFadden's assault trial, or if he was subject to perhaps being put on the jury for another trial that happened at roughly the same time in that court. Again, these are all excellent
questions. You only been caught up for jury duty twice 3 years ago before this trial and for the murder case.
That's all the information we have from the questionnaires, and the questionnaires are all the information we have. And these are all excellent questions, and they're the kinds of things that need to be fleshed out in some kind of proceeding where we can get all of that out on the record and make some real determination of what exactly did happen here and why. And that's, one way or another, that's what needs to happen.
So
in this
the
case.
Special master pointed, he said, Mr. Jimmy Williams says, I don't remember anything about this one thing. And
then we had the opportunity for the court to make some credibility determinations on that question, and we go from there.
What's the standard for intentional versus unintentional? Is it an objective reasonableness test, or is it a subjective test?
I believe it's probably an objective reasonableness test, but even under that test, I don't think this experience is the kind that necessarily falls under where you can necessarily say, given the lapse of time, that there's no way this juror could have forgotten any of this, or that this juror even retained any of this information in the first place. He could very easily have walked out of that courtroom that very day and said, boy, I'm glad that's over with, and flushed everything out of his mind. And I'm willing to bet a lot of people do just that. And frankly, reading a lot of voir dire transcripts, when people are asked about previous jury service, those that have served on juries, they may remember that they served on it. They may remember the nature of the case. Sometimes they struggle to remember. I'm not sure exactly when that was. Sometimes they struggle. Was that civil or criminal? Different people have different, I guess, attach different levels of importance to that kind of experience, have different levels of remembrance of that experience. And this
but absent any other evidence to the contrary, we would use an objective test, and that would be, we could use an objective test and say, well, he wouldn't remember it, unless there's some other...
Do the debt collection cases use an objective test or a subjective test?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't hear that.
The debt collection cases that were dealt with in our prior cases that talk about running cases, most of those cases were where people have been sued for collection.
Right.
Or maybe somebody had been a party to a divorce.
Right, exactly. Something that's so personal to that person that even though they may say they don't remember it, you can objectively say, well, that's not a reasonable to believe that. Being called in for jury duty isn't necessarily fit into that category. It's something you're compelled to do. You may not want to do it. You may not want to remember anything about it once it's over.
In those cases, do we apply a subjective test, or do we apply object, or do you not, or do you recall?
I don't recall particularly, and I'm sorry I don't. But and I do know that the main difference between them generally have been the presumption of prejudice, as Ms. Thompson pointed out. But certainly it's most.
I think there are some cases that say something is so unreasonable that you could not have forgotten it.
Right.
So.
And again, I don't believe this falls into that category. So that becomes a case where you take some evidence, find out what the juror has to say, and assess.
Maybe I'm missing it. I'm looking at Johnson v. McCullough. I don't see where it talks about 2915.
I may have responded to the, I may have given the wrong case. I know it's, I discussed it in my brief towards the end. Unfortunately, my ability to memorize case names was never good in the first place, and it's getting worse as the years go on.
I understand.
Welcome to my world.
You flushed it out of your system as well.
Well, that's a good point you make, because people come into my office all the time and ask me, what about this? Or actually, let me back up a little bit. We have a procedure in our office where I draft a brief, I give it to another person to proof. And it may take a week or two for them to get back to me. And they'll want to ask me something about that brief, and I say, what was that about? I have no idea. Once I'm finished with it, boom,
it's
out of my mind.
But once they say the name of it, then you probably remember it. So she's saying,
well, I need to kind of, not necessarily. Sometimes I have to ask, what was that about? And they tell me the issue, and I might remember the issue more than necessarily.
Is the focus of the juror nondisclosure at the time the question was asked?
Sure.
Or should we apply this test? Because usually the judge will say, you know, you have an obligation to update your answers if something occurred.
So do we
assume that by the end of the case, even if when he was initially asked he didn't remember them, that by the time all these facts came out, that that would have triggered it, and that makes it an intentional nondisclosure?
Well, I think that's, again, an area that, that could be and should be explored through gathering some evidence, because you're right, there is that duty to disclose, and maybe his memory was triggered, but if he really just didn't have a memory to begin with, there's nothing to trigger, and you know, we're again, speculation upon speculation, not an adequate basis to order an entirely new trial.
You cite the McQuarrie case from the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
That they say set a 2950.
All right, well, then it was mixed something, so I, that was at least halfway right. This is not an ad. There's just not enough evidence here at this point to say order a new trial. At some point in some proceeding, the more appropriate thing is to develop some evidence, and once that's done, this case or this issue can be analyzed in a more appropriate manner and disposed of in an appropriate manner. And unless the court has any other questions, we'd ask the conviction and sentence be affirmed.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Just briefly, Judge Breckenridge and Judge Stith, I think if you look at the Mays case, Mays talks about nondisclosure being intentional if the person either actually remembers the experience, so a subjective test, or it was of such significance that his purported forgetfulness is unreasonable.
Right.
And I think here that's what we have to look at. And Judge Breckenridge, I think what you said is most compelling in this case, because when you think about what this man heard about during that first voir dire on the assault cases, at least by, you know, at some point his duty to disclose is triggered. He hears about the assaults that he heard about specifically in that jury selection process 3 years earlier. And this isn't one of those things.
If we had case that then, as we have now, you'd be able to look it up and say, well, this person...
You know, and unfortunately, this is one of those things where, because he didn't make it onto the jury...
But I don't think he would have found it anyway.
Right. I mean, that's the problem. It's one of those things that he's... But, you know, I mean...
The case that's designed to catch those people...
Just the people that are served.
Parties.
Right. I mean, and that's the problem. I mean, CaseNet wouldn't have helped us, but it's one of those things that, you know, you say, how on earth are you going to catch it? And again, I don't think, as you pointed out, I don't think this is an IAC claim.
Maybe by asking if you served on prior jury.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have to figure out some way to catch these folks.
Well, what if defense counsel or the state, either one, would have asked those potential jurors about their prior jury service? Why isn't that at least a potential ineffective assistance of counsel claim? In other words, if somebody's listed prior criminal jury service in an assault case, and you're the defense lawyer, and your client has a prior assault charge, nobody suspects you've got the lottery where somebody was previously a veneer person, but doesn't that seem like a reasonable question to ask? And often don't we ask those who have prior criminal jury service, did you find them guilty or not? Did you find them not guilty? Those are very standard questions that one might expect to be asked in a death penalty case, I would think.
And I think that's a good point, Your Honor. I could, however, I could probably write the state's response on the PCR to that claim. And I'm certain we would hear that as being, oh, well, you know, that wasn't ineffective assistance here for not pursuing that avenue. Because why would they have suspected it?
Well, they could bring in an ineffective assistance counsel, and then it comes up and says, no way, that can't be happening.
Well, McQuarrie says in addition to 2915 being for ineffective assistance, where the alleged errors amount to constitutional violations, they may be addressed if exceptional circumstances are shown which justify not raising the grounds on direct appeal, citing a 97 case of ours. And then they go ahead and address it as part of the 2915.
Well, and I think, Your Honor, the question again becomes, as I began, you know, what are we going to do? How is this court going to address this problem? And is it a good use of limited resources to affirm and send this on to
the opposing argument is, should this court make an assumption and use the limited resources to try this person for the third time? So you holding the hearing to determine it is a much better use of resources than ordering a third time.
Well, and I think that might be splitting the baby. If you do the special master approach, that would be certainly a smaller use of resources than sending it on its merry way to PCR land, because a PCR is going to take inordinate amounts of resources. And if that's the decision that this court makes, I think we're going to, you know, we know there's a problem. We know that there's going to be questions of trial counsel as to whether they would have wanted this man on this jury. And had they known that this man had this prior experience, would they have wanted him? Would he have been the subject of a cause strike? And I think that's the question that's before this court. So it's really a question of how do we use resources? And again, given the Mays articulation of your test, is it reasonable to assume that this forgetfulness, and that's the word that the Mays court uses, I think, forgetfulness, is that reasonable to assume that was forgotten?
Of course, the answer would be fairly predictable, that no, they wouldn't want him on the jury. They said they would have wanted him, that's a different answer. I mean, I assume that the defense counsel said, no, but I known this, we wouldn't have wanted him on the jury.
Well, and I, in fact, talked to defense counsel, and their response was total horror. That's not in the record, but that's just, you know.
How do we know the witness won't admit or won't say, well, it came to me, but I just didn't think it was important, and I didn't know what to do.
And
I mean, that's the problem with deciding a case without a record of any kind. But.
Well, and at that point, Judge, I think you have non-disclosure. You may have unintentional non-disclosure, and then you have a question of prejudice.
In the civil cases where people found out after the fact, there were affidavits submitted in the case, and mm-hmm. I think we actually sent it back for live testimony.
Well, and in fact, I think in the Johnson versus McCulloch case, that was a question that the other party raised, because Judge Witt didn't ask for testimony, affidavits, anything like that. Right. And the question there was, and this court found, that the question that was asked was sufficiently clear that there really wasn't a reason to assume that this witness had misunderstood, had forgotten any of that kind of stuff. And I think those are the questions that this court needs to look at under the articulation of the test in Johnson versus McCulloch in Mays. Were Judge Gartner's questions sufficiently clear? Were what Mr. Larner then brought up in voir dire, in that death penalty voir dire that he did with that panel, specifically addressed to Mr. Williams, and then later on, as Judge Breckenridge suggests, at some point, did the light bulb go off for this man and say, oh my, this is the same case? I would request that this court not send this on to post-conviction, but find a remedy that guarantees my client the right to a fundamentally fair jury trial. Thank you.
Thank you for your candor and excellent